Well, I think all of you have met Dr. Rhodes Boysen by this time. And I first met him, I guess it was about 10 years ago, when I was at St. Andrews University in Scotland, where Dr. Boysen has since become the president of the Conservative Association there, that being the most conservative both association and university in general in Britain, and possibly in the English-speaking world. In fact, probably. When Dr. Boysen first came to a party I had at my apartment in St. Andrews, as some of you may know, I have a small collection of Vanity Fair prints, which were given to me by my good friend Madsen Peary. As you know, the Vanity Fair prints all contain portraits of Victorian statesmen, as they are now called. They were, of course, politicians, such as Disraeli, the Marquess of Salisbury, Gladstone, people like that. And Dr. Boysen came in with a mutual friend, and my first impulse was to hang him back up on my wall. But I recovered myself in time, and so I shook his hand instead. Dr. Boysen was elected to Parliament relatively recently, only about 2 years ago. But in a very short time, he has made a considerable impact. In fact, he is now a deputy a shadow minister of education in Mrs. Thatcher's front bench. He's written a great many books, both on history, which is his academic field, and, of course, of politics. He was headmaster of a very interesting grammar school for several years, and has written a book about that experience, which is quite interesting. He's also was the founder and publisher of the Constitutional Book Club, and has written really profusely for the press and journals and so on his political ideas. In a recent poll, in fact, despite his rather recent entry into politics, as you may know, he was originally a Laborite until 1960, and then he ran on the Conservative Party a few years ago. Despite his rather recent entry into Conservative politics, he was elected in the poll as the third most popular Tory in Britain, after Mrs. Thatcher, of course, and Ted Heath, who is still remembered by some people. I think we have considerable reason to hope, as you will see yourself when you hear him, if you haven't met him before, that perhaps 7 or 8 years from now, after Mrs. Thatcher has her 4 or 5 years, of course, that Dr. Boysen will be staying not in Ed Fulner's basement, but in Blair House, So, Dr. Boysen.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be introduced by Bob Schuttinger, as one never knows what's going to be said, and one sometimes wonders afterwards what has been said. But I must say it's nice to be here with you over this weekend, and also to be at the Philadelphia Society, which was created by you to the exchange of ideas about a free economic and political system, and which brings together academics and businessmen and journalists so successfully. What I want to talk about today is the title. I always think it's courteous to an audience if one actually refers to the title at the beginning and the end, and so that one ensures that something in between of the sandwich is applicable in the lessons that one can follow. When I talk about the intellectual defense of the West, what I mean is of Western ideas. Obviously, we are willing at any stage of time for the East to acquire those ideas if it sees ultimately the truth of them as we would hope. And the ideas basically are those which have been so well written about by Hayek and Mises and Popper. The emphasis on the individual as against the state. Although I am a Tory, I am not a Whig, and thus I accept the nation state in a way that classical liberals always had difficulties of doing. But the emphasis within the nation state, and indeed for the strength of the nation state, of the individuals within it. Secondly, the rule of law, and the emphasis on the freedom of the individual which follows from that. And thirdly, what makes everything of that possible, and which brought me, along with other reasons from the left of British politics some 15 years ago, to the right, the sense that liberty can only exist where there is not only the rule of law, but also the possession of private property. That if private property disappears, then it's only a matter of time before some form of totalitarian regime, collectivist regime, will supersede it. I accept that the free society is not ideal. I became a Tory when I discovered the Garden of Eden, the non-perfectibility of men, including myself and even my wife. And when when this occurred to me, it did move to the idea that this was the most tolerable form of society known to man, and is one that is worth preserving, because a free society as we understand it has been only a temporary, I would hate to think, aberration in the history of mankind compared with the dark ages of totalitarianism. I shan't refer at all to the question of military defence of the free world, although that is a particularly important one, and one that Britain certainly, under the recent Labour governments, has not played its part in its share of the defence of the free world. But I want to deal with the intellectual one, the arguments as I see it, particularly bearing in mind the experience in Britain for the continuance of a free society. The first body of enemies, and the best way often is to, we can agree about our enemies if we can't always agree about our friends. And it concentrates the mind to decide for a beginning what one disagrees with, and then in the broad alliance that we fight for the preservation of those values upon which we make our judgment of disagreement. The first group of disagreement is the question of socialism, of which we have got a great example, meaning by great, large and not famous example in Britain at the present time. The socialists set out to con people, naive people, honest people, good people, in a belief that a private enterprise society led to despotism upon ordinary people, because only those who possessed large factories and works were free within it. That unless you could go to the Ritz and could afford a dinner at the Ritz, nobody else was free. And it ground to death the liberties and also the economic standard of living of the working class, and indeed much of the middle class within it. That basically is what socialism is about. That if everything is collectivized within the state, then it will be shared out equally, so that everybody has more economic goods apart from the small minority of capitalists that existed before, and also everybody will be freer, because you will not have the large discrepancies of income which existed under the capitalist free society. Now, we don't need any longer to talk about this as a kind of laboratory experiment that does not exist. One can look at the situation in Britain, which moved me in my political views, and to see what socialism means in practice, as against it being an intellectual parlour game in the gin and tonic belt, as to what it is when it actually exists. Nationalised industries immediately follow under socialism. And something like 44% of the industries in Britain are nationalised and totally owned by the government. This has not meant either that there is a higher standard of living, that there is no unemployment, that we are meeting world markets, or the individual is free. Indeed, it means a new form of serfdom, because if there is only one employer, if you disagree with that employer, then you're like a refusenik in Russia. You're an outcast, a parasite on society, and you have no freedom at all. Even in the medieval village, and I know that one time there were connections between the United States, or what became the United States, and Britain, there were certain disagreements in the 18th century, and I forgive you for those. It's these happen even amongst friends. But even in the medieval village of feudalism, people could still run away. I mean, there's many novels of that. You had your Robin Hoods and your other people of that type. But you could still run away into the woods, and you could still hope to be acquired by some other lord of the manor somewhere, provided you could do a job for him. But if you're employed by the British steel industry or British coal mines, totally nationalised, if you fall out and you're blacklisted by that nationalised concern, you will never work again in that industry. And that any individual working class must bow, touch their forelock to the union boss, because they are closed shop industries, or the nationalised industries, day by day to keep their job. And it is a form of serfdom that has come in. Prince Philip said in a broadcast recently, it is worth bearing in mind that slavery is no more than a system of directed labor with fringe benefits. And it basically is what socialism is, because we haven't got to directed labor yet, but directed labor will have to come within such a society, because it's the only way. When you can't move people by wages, you will have to move them by specific direction to save those industries from even greater collapse. If one now talks about the efficiency of those against the freedom of the individual, between 1948 and 1970, the prices in the nationalized industries went up by 245%. The prices in private industry went up by 135%. I mean, there's a test of your of efficiency for you. The prices of nationalized industries went up basically twice as fast as in private industry. And in the time of monetary incontinence, which we're just coming out of at the present time, I believe a second popular Tory, Mr. Heath, had a degree of connections with. I mean, there's a lot of people on our own side we have to save before we can start with the others. But between 1974 and 1977, the prices of nationalized industries went up 111%. The general price rise was 83%. And on my calculations, the price rises of private industry went up 65%. So again, you have up to the present time the inefficiency of the nationalized against the efficient or the independent industries being brought into line. At the moment that we are sitting here, I haven't calculated to a penny upon this, but the steel industry is losing in Britain £2 million a day. That is what it is losing in Britain, and nobody knows how to sort it out, because nobody knows who is in charge of this great colossus now of the nationalised industry to make a decision about it. £2 million a day is being lost by nationalised steel, and nothing is being done about it. Nobody dare shut anything down because of works revolts there are marginal seats and all the problems that come to it. Who would have believed that we would have a shortage of coal in Britain? The Almighty that blessed us at one time, and there are difficulties, he doesn't, he curses who he loves at times otherwise, but we are an island of coal in a sea of fish. When one talks about resources, we were created an island of coal in a sea of fish, which is pretty good going, and something we don't grumble about. We now have a shortage of coal in Britain. In 1945, when the coal industry was nationalised, it then raised 240 million tonnes a year. This year, it will raise only 105 million tonnes. It has gone down to less than half of what it raised when it was a privately run industry. And remember, even before that, when we exported with coalers and bunkers, indeed, throughout the whole of the world. It is only, I always say, a socialist communist government, or a socialist government in Britain, because there's communist tendencies, but they're not there, and Eurocommunism doesn't exist in Britain, really, as an effective political force in any way. But it's only socialism that could create a shortage of coal in Britain. Similarly, it is only socialism that would create a shortage of snow today in Washington. If you had a socialist commune in charge here, there would already be a shortage of snow, or in sand of the desert in the Sahara. The second one of the left says is the question of the welfare state, which I believe is threatening. Medicare and other strange names are knocking on the doors of your country. The idea, again, being good people, naive people, people who do not read the book of history, who say that it is wrong that people have to pay money for medical care. It should be free to everybody according to requirements, their personal requirements. Similarly, in housing, they should have housing according to their requirements or respective economic costing. And similarly, if they are ill, if they are unemployed, they should be cared for just the same as they were working. Now, in theory, most of us, although would accept that as a good wish, it is not necessarily evil people who have that particular viewpoint. But what happens again once this comes into being? And let's look particularly at the health service because of the threat of Medicare to your country. The first thing that happens, if the cost of medical services comes from the government, thus from taxation, instead of the individual pocket, nobody can get enough money spent upon it because people are not prepared to spend as much money on people's medical care they have not met as upon their own, their families, their churches and their neighbourhood. I mean, I always say about this, the Good Samaritan met somebody. It wasn't a donation to poverty in the Far East or the Third World. It was actually something he actually did himself by somebody he met within his acquaintances. And people will do that, but they will not give donations to people they have not met and who they may not like if they meet under those conditions. We spend at the present time 6.5% of gross national product on our medical services. which is the lowest in the Western world. We were spending more before the National Health Service came in. And even the Labour government now knows it must reduce taxation, otherwise it will lose an election. And there is no means on earth of national funding of spending more on health in Britain, because nobody will pay the taxes for it. As you know, throughout the Western world, something like 6.5% to 8% of gross national product it goes on health. In Britain, one only spends 5.5%. You take away the economic market of pay, whatever you do it by, friendly societies or insurance companies or what, but you don't then have no market. You replace an economic market by two other things. One is the queue. You regulate by the queue. And second, you have a political market. Let's deal, first of all, with the political market. If you are politically important, it has been a perk, an advantage to rulers of all countries in all time, is special medical care. I do not imagine that Brezhnev would have been put back at the queue compared with a Georgian peasant in his health at the present time, and there's an egalitarian approach to health. I do not expect a British Member of Parliament although I member private insurance firms, let me just say that, to wait in a long queue behind some of his constituents for medical attention when it comes. But more than that, if you are in a constituency of a powerful Member of Parliament, like the one for Brent North, Bob Schuttinger did not say which seat I sat for, but if you're a member of Brent North, and if you contact the Member of Parliament, the odds are you'll be in the hospital the following day when you raise it within the political machine, and you replace an economic market to a political market which is much worse and is unable to be handled by an ordinary person, because political markets are highly sophisticated, whereas most people understand money, insurance policies, and friendly societies. Now, as for the queue, the queues in many areas of Britain, in downtown areas where people do not want to give medical advice, compared with good suburban areas, the queues are longer, and there are so many waiting often in the doctor's surgery when you go. If you're not ill when you go, by God, you're ill by the time you come out from it there. Whereas if you're in a good suburban area where doctors want to practice and where it is very nice and you're not going to have unpleasant complaints, etc., then, I mean, you'll do it by personal allotting of time when you come, but not in downtown areas. At the moment, 600,000 people are waiting for hospital beds in Britain. 600,000, that is out of a population of 50 million. That is the longest queue of anywhere in the Western world, percentage-wise. And 3 out of 10 of those have been waiting for over a year. And we have less hospital beds now than when the National Health Service came in 1947. And the numbers are still going down, the bed services per patient in our country. Look at the question of brain scanners. It was mentioned by, I think, Harris Watts in The Future That Does Not Work, that many of you have read, and which I think is a splendid book, and which is accurate in practically every detail. They were invented by EMI in Britain. They are produced and patented in Britain. And at the point when it was calculated for the article in that book, there was something like 700 already in use in the United States, compared with something like only a 12 or 24 in the whole of Britain, because the health service could not afford to buy them, though it has actually transformed the whole of brain surgery and brain operations within it. I mean, it's only a matter of time before all the Japanese have their own brain scanners with them that we see going around the world our aircraft. So, presumably, if any of us want to have brain scanning there, although we invent it, one has to come to somewhere outside to hope that one attacks to that service. The only other point I'd mention on health is this, as to what actually happens in reality on this, that we have 2,750 hospitals in Britain, and only 80 have been built since the National Health Service, which is now 31 years ago since it came in. So in those 31 years, 80 have been built of the 2,750 hospitals, so that Britain's health service is basically running on Victorian and Edwardian free enterprise of the past, of the collections made privately at that time. Two other illustrations I'd like to do quicker on the welfare state. One is housing, which again overlaps yours. I won't talk about, rent control, It doesn't make housing cheap, it makes it unobtainable. I mean, that's basically what happens from it. We had our first rent controls in 1915, when nobody was allowed to raise rents higher than they were in August 1914. They have never been removed. Nobody can afford to build houses now for the working classes or the lower middle class. So the state knocking houses down on its so-called slum clearance, putting up houses which are usually much worse than those they knock down, actually has to build them by municipal so-called enterprise. And they have to be heavily subsidised before anybody will live in them. I have in my constituency houses that are being subsidised £3,000 a year, municipalised houses. That's £60 a week. What, $120 a week subsidy is the amount of subsidy upon those houses, just below the average wage in Britain. Nobody can afford to buy their own houses now, and there certainly aren't any to rent privately, because they're having to pay taxes to subsidise themselves and other people. It's a vicious circle, so that they're trapped within it. And once you've got a council house, it's worse than a medieval housing. It's just like the feudal village. You can't move anywhere else. This is one reason about job immobility in Britain. When you get your council house, you are there for life. You only have 1/5, 20% of the movement in council housing that one has in private enterprise occupied housing, because you won't get it anywhere else. It is part of your perquisites of the welfare state, and you stay there, unemployed or not. And if your young people have lived in it for some time, they will inherit it in the will after them. It's almost like a feudal tenancy or the open strip system that preceded the enclosures, which had been revived at our time. Nobody wants to live in these. They are centres of crime, in many cases there, with a lot of honest people trapped within them. And not only is it immobility, it's also the conditions of those houses. We have knocked down what was in the east end of London, horizontal slums, and we have built vertical slums to replace them. We've actually raised them up and vertically. And vertical slums are much worse than horizontal slums, because you can get out of the horizontal slums much faster through your front door than the 17th floor of a vertical slum when the lifts have not been working for 3 weeks because of vandalism within it. And we're having problems of ghettos in Britain, which we never knew about 20 years ago, by the virtues of this council house building. Let me just give you one other figure on housing as to what socialism means in practice. We have 2 million less people living in London now than in 1939. But we have 500,000 more houses, and we now have a housing shortage in London that did not exist in 1939. Shall I say that again? That's very good. In 1939, there were then 2 million people living in 2 million less people living in London than now. At that time, there were 500,000 less houses in London than they are now. And yet there wasn't a housing shortage in London then, which there is now. The reason being that if you've got a large house, you don't rent it out to anybody else in any way, because you can't get them out. And old people are living in houses with 4 or 5 bedrooms. They don't, because of the rent acts, get anybody in, because once you get them in, you can never get them out again. And you must have millions of rooms that could be rented out on a free enterprise system all over London, ice-booked, because of this situation. The third and final one on the welfare state is the question of social security. To pay people to be unemployed to make sure they are not worse off. Something like a third of the working people in Britain would now be better off unemployed than working. The wonder of Britain is that it's such a hard-working society that anybody works at all. This is the wonder to me of Britain. Not that we have strikes, not that we have unemployed, but anybody goes to work within the economic system. Probably eventually they won't do. There's still the remains of the thrift Puritan ethic actually driving them on, or they want to get away from the wife, or they've some reason to go to work on each day. The ordinary person, the average person in Britain, increases his income over the year if he is unemployed for 11 weeks or he is on strike for 11 weeks. If he does that 11 weeks in a year, he increases his gross income for the year. First, because he gets supplementary benefits when he's out of work, which are actually going up faster than actually wages in Britain at the moment. Secondly, he gets tax rebate. And the level of taxation is such in Britain now that as in 1949, a man and wife with 2 children had to earn 3% more than the average wage before he paid tax. And man, wife and 2 children now pay tax when they earn 49% of the average income. So that, I mean, he gets that tax back freely when he's unemployed, and he is better off on it. I mean, the degree of taxation, as you know, 83% at the maximum on earned income, 98% on unearned income, 54% going to government. Remember, in Allende's Chile in 1975, 60% went to government. And it's on Milton Friedman, one of the reasons for what happened there. There's all the scenario for a similar happening in Britain at the present time. One also adds, quickly on 3 other points, the attack on the intellectual West, on our free societies, also comes from the millennium secularists who believe that socialism will work here if it doesn't work anywhere else. But the comparison must be made, compared with these Cloud 7 people, between areas where capitalism is working and areas where socialism is working. I mean, that argument must now be killed, that it's going to be different in one country. It's the same farcical argument of Eurocommunism, for which I have no more belief than I have in Brezhnev or Stalin's communism. It is but the Trojan horses to bring in the hard men. I said yesterday, lunchtime, I'd sooner deal with the far left in the Labour Party any day than the moderate right of the Labour Party, because the far left are at least honest. They know what they want. And the moderates in the Labour Party are the Trojan horses who will bring it about. And the extremists do say we want socialism, and we want it now. And the moderates say we want socialism, but only when my child has gone through the local grammar school and I've had a private operation for hernia in the local payback. And I know which of these two I think is a more honourable statement of the good man between them. It is that reality that must be done. Let me say something similarly on trade unions, and I know that Reid Larson is here, has done so much in your country about this. It is on the question of trade unions. It was said they would defend the working man. They would also make sure that you had an economically viable system. There is no doubt that one of the reasons of the low economic viability of Britain is the pressure of trade unions for restrictive practices and not closing down plant that is no longer competitive throughout the world. And as a matter of interest of what they do for the individual, the average wage of typists in London, which is completely unorganised, has gone up much higher in Britain proportionately since the war than the wages of the dockers and the miners, who are the most highly organised amongst the trade unions. That the ones, the unions, the individuals who are working in non-unionised trades throughout Britain have increased their wages proportionately much higher than the ones who are supposed to have the unions protecting them at that time. Well, we have the closed shop tyranny. We haven't had shootings, which I believe in certain coal mines you had some strange things over here, which we read about in Britain. It crosses the Atlantic from time to time, information about this. But we have actually the mass picketing, and we also have with it the restrictive practices, which I've already mentioned. The other two things I would mention, one which links up with what people talked about this morning and which I enjoyed listening to. The first is the paternalists, the ones who say that people cannot work. We had in the Webbs and you had the whole tradition of this middle-class socialism in Britain, that people could not decide for themselves. That somebody could know what people wanted better than they want themselves. Two things can be said about that, and Hayek has said them much better than myself. I put them in my own vernacular. I owe so much to Hayek, and I'm glad that somebody quoted from him this morning. I mean, I knew my views, my prejudices, but he actually put flesh on the bones, did Hayek. I then knew I was right. I felt I was right before, but I wanted to tell other people why I was right. Blind prejudice can't do that. One has to build the facts and the figures up around it. Where Hayek says, undoubtedly for every one of, I'm doing it in my language now, that every one of you in this room, there is somewhere in the world somebody who knows what is better for you than you know yourself. But in 70 years, you'll never find him. And that is very true. I mean, he may be in Cambodia. He may be in Thailand. Somewhere in the world, there is somebody there. But the life is too short to find him, so you better make decisions for yourself. Because certainly the other people don't know what's better for you than you do yourself. And the second one from Brett. And that is, life is so complicated now that you must have somebody to help you in leading reins through it. But life is only so complicated because of government. I mean, you've got the government off our backs. Life is no more complicated than a medieval village. To my mind, it is less complicated because they're dependent on the changes of the weather, like the airport apparently is still here. I mean, it's nice to see the breakthrough of natural causes from time to time beyond computers and the rest. But I mean, they were dependent every day on the weather. But it's just the same in America. People go to work at the same time every day. They talk to the same people. They ate the same lunch with the same people. They come home the same time. They watch the same baseball games or the same soccer matches in England. They go on collective tours, coral around London or wherever they may be going. I mean, the idea that life is complicated for them. The only thing that complicated are their tax forms, Employment Protection Acts, which means more unemployment as here as in there, Minority Rights Acts and all these. Without government, life is as simple as it was, if not more simple, at the time of medieval times. And finally, the biggest threat in Britain, and one which I was very interested in your discussions this morning, is the question of tyranny of a one-chamber government. I believe as strongly as the Founding Fathers, if I dare say so, in the separation of powers, that no man, not even myself, and that's saying quite a lot, deserves all power on this. That all of us must be balanced up on this balance of power. It was British policy internationally. It is the only way to keep freedom individually as well on this. In Britain, where, as one of your people this morning said, I think it was Dr. Carey, in conversation to me afterwards, that we basically have no constitution now. British democracy could be wiped out by one left-wing government in one term of office. I mean, the Crown basically has no power apart from strange accidents, which could arise on choice between two leaders, or one or two instances of that type. The House of Lords can only delay for 1 year. It is now threatened by abolition by the Labour Party itself. And it's interesting that we once lost the House of Lords before, in 1649 in the Commonwealth, and in 1653, Cromwell went in and took the bubble away from the House of Commons similarly, and we lost all our democracy at that time. And since Michael Foot, the Lord Privy Seal, is a great admirer of Cromwell, one can see the writing on the wall as to what could happen from that party. After all, in October 74, the Labour Party won the election in Britain with 29% of the electorate voting for them only. 37% of those who voted, and that made up 29% of the total electorate. Since there is no High Court they're going to, since there is no Bill of Rights, since there is no Senate to balance that off, they can change the face of Britain in 3 or 4 years and destroy the whole of our liberties at that time. And that is the most dangerous thing in Britain, and why people like Lord Hailsham and myself are pressing for bills of rights, or the return even for the House of Lords, or anything, or finally the referendum. I've moved, as I said yesterday, towards on something else, the referendum. That, I mean, that before any change must be, there must be a vote of the people. I believe the man and the woman in the street in Britain is more conservative than he is in America. We are the most traditional conservative people of all, and they do not like collectivism. It's just the inability of the Conservative Party to communicate with a man in the street. I better not develop that further. It could be dangerous if I said why. And so don't ask me afterwards why. Ask me in private conversation, but not with the tape recorder here. And I shall say why I think why. But if we could only communicate, there is no doubt that we could have a real right-wing, conservative, free enterprise government within the nation state of Britain. Let me conclude by saying this on the question of these various lines, just by saying, all the arguments for the destruction of the free society can now be answered from reality as well as on theory. Socialism has destroyed the liberty of the ordinary man in Britain, and it is also destroying our economic efficiency. And it is interesting that the swing to the Conservative Party last year in the by-elections in Britain was twice as much in working-class areas and three times as much in others. We actually won mining seats, which we've never even hardly thought worthwhile contesting before, than it was in middle-class areas. Quite simply, because in working-class areas, they're the ones who are being ground to death by socialism and the welfare state, whereas the upper middle class know how to work the levers, and they gain the good jobs and the plums within it. They are the new bureaucracy there. I mean, it's interesting. I like Disraeli. We shall have to save by an alliance again with the masses of our people who do not like what is going on. Similarly, upon the welfare state, they are at the back of the queue. Similarly, we have the threat of one-party government destroying Britain in one term of office, or one party with a temporary majority. And it happened in Rome, and it happened in ancient Greece before. It is nothing new, where democracy was destroyed overnight by the demands for welfare states, etc. Solzhenitsyn said, soon after he came to your country, "Our experience is vitally important to the West, because by some chance of history, we have taken the path the West is taking 70 or 80 years before the West. Our situation in Britain is something like 10 to 20 years before you, that we have trod a path, not as an object lesson for you, but as a warning for ourselves who can still reverse it, and for yourselves at the present time. In two world wars, in 1418 and in 39-45, the alliance of Britain and America, which I see as the Greece and Rome of the modern world, both in our thought and in our kinship of the free society at the bottom, it was your armies that helped to preserve the free world with ours at that time. It is not now that we require any material or military aid from you, apart from the defence of the free world, we accept on that, but material aid like martial aid or anything of that type. What we require is the assurance in Britain of the intellectual purity of your thought for the battle we are fighting there. And what I like to think is, when we are debating in the House of Commons and we're having our meetings over there, that when we are discussing what exists, that when there's a clapping at the end of a meeting, I would like to think there is a similar re-echo of what is happening over here in the United States. And one thing I enjoy coming over here once or twice a year through my connection with Ed Fulner and other people here, and their friendships have been one of my most enjoyable experiences over the last few years, the close friendships, and Don Lipsit and the others, close friendships I have built up. What I come for is to recharge my batteries inside your free society. And similarly, the same as I come here to get my batteries recharged and to go around speaking in your country, usually every September. Similarly, by what telling you what is happening in Britain, I hope I can recharge your batteries to tell you similarly as yesterday that what is happening in Britain is disastrous in socialism, but it is not irreversible. The spark of freedom in man beats into the breasts of Englishmen yet, as in your country. That I do believe that socialism is over the top, that a creed is always under attack when you think it is most powerful. The same as in 1907, one British politician said, we're all socialists now. The strange thing is happening on the socialism in Britain, that my driver to the airport 2 days ago said to me, an ordinary man, I voted Labour all my life, and I suddenly realise I'm not a socialist at all. I shall be voting for your party at the next election. That between the alliance of our two countries, just as we did militarily in those two world wars, we hope that we can preserve between us the free world.